You're listening to Health Connections, a show about people, health, and policy. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Our guest this time is Dr. Jennifer Jabson. She studies LGBTQ health issues at the University of Tennessee Department of Public Health. For more on her research and what all this means, I turn things over to my co-host, Dr. Carol Myers.
On several occasions on Health Connections, we've discussed health disparities. Today, we're going to look at health disparities for a specific population. A health disparity is a difference in health care or services received, or a difference in health outcomes. The concept of health disparities has taken on additional meaning. If the difference is avoidable or changeable, and the difference is considered unfair, then it is also considered unjust and is viewed as a question of equity. Let me explain. Genetic differences are not necessarily avoidable or changeable. This would not be considered unjust. However, if a person with a genetic difference is treated differently, either consciously or unconsciously, this would be considered to be unfair. That's what we're going to talk about today. Dr. Jabson is here today to discuss disparities associated with LGBTQ individuals. Dr. Jabson, let's start with a definition of terms. I think it's always a good place. Just what does LGBTQ mean?
It's a good question, Dr. Myers. Thanks for inviting me and letting me answer this question. LGBT is really an umbrella term that refers to individuals who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. And just a moment about all these letters. We have sexual orientation. We all have sexual orientation. And people who identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual, these are terms that refer to sexual orientation where people are attracted romantically to the same sex person. Transgender is a term that refers to gender and gender identity. We all have gender identity. People who have a cisgender gender identity have a gender expression that matches with their biological sex assigned at birth. Transgender individuals are individuals who may not have that same match. Transgender individuals are people who sometimes then go through some degree of a transition in order to have their gender expression match with how they feel, their self-concept.
When we talk about disparities and disparities sometimes in how we treat people, I'm concerned that as a healthcare provider or in other roles, I may have inadvertently not been as inclusive as I would like to be to LGBTQ individuals. Can you talk about this and paint a picture of the experiences common to LGBTQ individuals when it comes to feeling inclusive or not feeling inclusive?
It's a really important question, and the research that I've done in East Tennessee has informed part of this. And that is that LGBT people have told me again and again and again in my research that when they go to the healthcare setting, although their providers may be very well intended, they often feel afraid. They're afraid that they're going to experience discrimination. Women and men have told me that they've gone to the healthcare provider in a crisis situation and have had to lie about their relationships with their partners in order to get the care that they need or be able to see their partner or their child who's experiencing a health crisis. So these are all issues that can inadvertently happen when in the healthcare setting. Now, I have done research with providers who all tell me that they intend very strongly to treat LGBT people just the same as they treat all patients, but they also tell me they don't understand how their behavior might be different or oppressive or not inclusive of an LGBT experience.
So it'd be interesting, how do we influence that? How do we take well-intentioned providers and help them be more welcoming and therefore be better prepared to provide culturally sensitive care to LGBTQ individuals?
This is a problem we're working with all across the nation. And one of the things we talk a lot about is the potential for training providers in something called cultural humility or culturally competent care. And cultural humility, care that is culturally
humble,
is care where a provider may not hold themselves an LGBT identity, but they understand and have been trained in how to think about making their care settings inclusive. Cultural competence is learning about what kinds of disparities and issues LGBT people are experiencing. And in many cases, institutions have established protocols in which people who identify as LGBT are invited to disclose their orientation, are asked to bring their partners, where gender identity is freely and openly discussed in the clinical setting with hetero and cisgendered people, as well as transgender and LGB people, so that it's a culture shift, a climate shift within healthcare institutions, as well as knowledge building.
Does that training have good results?
Well, this is something we're working on. Not all trainings have been evaluated. Unfortunately, many times healthcare institutions have the very well intention of establishing a protocol for training and then don't have the resources to evaluate it. So right now we're trying to work with various organizations to do those kinds of evaluations.
So we said that health disparities can be related to the care delivered or the outcomes, health outcomes. So what are the major disparities, if you haven't already discussed them, associated with the delivery of healthcare and services? Are there other things that you would like to mention?
Well, what we know is that many LGBT people tell us in health surveillance data, so the types of data that we get that are across the population and are representative of all Americans, tell us that LGBT people are not getting care that they need in a timely fashion, including primary care and preventative care, things that could keep them healthy for a long time. And they tell us they don't go because they're scared, or they tell us that when they go, their providers aren't listening and answering their questions. We also know that LGBT people are less likely to receive timely care for a chronic condition, and they go in much later than what we would hope so that we can have early impact on treatment for better outcomes.
So in what ways are health outcomes most disparate for LGBTQ individuals? What are some of the things that really are on the radar screen and getting people's attention?
It's an excellent question and something that is relatively new, but we have two Institute of Medicine reports that have been published that have summarized some very rigorous science in this area. And what we know is that the disparities are not the same for all of the categories of people included in the acronym LGBT. So for lesbian and bisexually identified women, for instance, we know that their risk for cardiovascular disease and breast cancer is significantly higher as compared to their heterosexual counterparts. Men who have sex with men, gay men, and bisexual men have a much higher rate of HIV and AIDS. We also know that people who identify as trans or transgender are experiencing significant disparities in other forms of chronic disease.
So you're really echoing a theme that we've talked about a lot on Health Connections, is that it's complicated. There's not one answer. And one of the things we have to do is first be attuned to a problem or a difference, and then we need to look at how it affects different groups of people different ways. So you very much have illustrated that. Not long ago, we looked at social isolation, and I was very interested to see the concerns not only with older Americans and then men in middle age, but that the concerns were exacerbated when we looked at people that identified as LGBT or Q. So are there other conditions where we know there's already a propensity and then it's made worse or exacerbated by sexual orientation or gender?
Well, it's an interesting question that sort of gets at these underlying mechanisms. And unfortunately, we are still sort of in the early infancy of these kinds of tests scientifically in the field. But what we do know is that minority stressors, we all experience stress, but for LGBT people, they also experience this thing called minority stress that is multi-level. It comes from institutions, it comes from interpersonal relationships, and there is social isolation involved in that. So certainly you can kind of imagine a time in which maybe we all experience social isolation for one reason or another, but LGBT people might then also be experiencing an increase or a magnitude greater of social isolation depending on where they live. We know that in Appalachia, actually, many people who identify as LGBTQ have experienced significant social isolation, rejection from family. Not all, but some. And that can have a really significant impact on their health.
So what can I do, what can our listeners do to address disparities associated with being LGBT or Q?
It's a wonderful question, and I always tell people that we can all be part of the solution. We don't have to identify as an LGBT individual to be part of solving these problems. There's lots of ways we can all get involved. So I have three sort of kernels I like to share with people.
Great.
The first is I encourage people to get politically engaged. We need to stay up to date on active bills in the General Assembly. You can also become a contributor and a supporter of the Tennessee Equality Project if you're local to Tennessee. They're an organization that advocates on behalf of LGBT rights and equity here. I also tell folks that they can get educated about LGBT issues and health by attending and supporting LGBT-related events. Many times I think people imagine they must be LGBT in order to go to these kinds of events, but that simply isn't the case. For example, on April 6th, together with the Pride Center here at UT and the Commission for LGBT People, I'm hosting the Appalachian LGBT Health Equity Symposium. And this event will showcase issues affecting the health of LGBT people in our region, describe their needs, and start to talk about solutions for how we might change health inequities for people here in Tennessee.
One of the things that interested me in the seminar that you discussed that's upcoming is the juxtaposition of LGBTQ and Appalachia. Can you speak a little bit about that? Are there nuances related to being an individual that identifies as LGBTQ in Appalachia than, let's say, in San Francisco or Philadelphia?
It's a really important question. And I'm not from Appalachia, so I must be very careful, and I defer to the people who have spoken to me about that. And what participants in my research have told me is that they hold both of these identities, these intersecting identities, as an LGBTQ person and as someone who's grown up and lived in Appalachia, very seriously, that they don't want to reject either of these identities, and yet that the sociopolitical climate in Appalachia sometimes leaves them feeling left out and like they don't matter and rejected in some cases. And yet their LGBT identity doesn't necessarily they don't want to leave Appalachia to go to a more urban place or somewhere outside of Appalachia, but their LGBT identity is really important to them as well. So there's this conflict, this wrestling that happens, at least as I understand it from people I've spoken with.
Well, Dr. Japsen, it has been a delight to have you here in the studio today, and I applaud you for your work, and I invite our listeners, if they have questions, we will pass them on to you.
Sounds great. I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Health Connections. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.